Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria, and I want to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is the recording artist J.S. Onka. To download his new EP called EP1, visit www.jsonka.com. That's J-S-O-N-C-A, Onka. Audio files, you can also pre-order his new tracks on a black or a limited edition color vinyl right there on his site. EP1 was written, performed, recorded, and mixed, a man of many talents, by J.S. Onka himself, and it features a blend of Indian classical, West African folk, and contemporary Western music. So don't wait. Go to www.jsonka.com to support this incredible artist and download EP1 today. That's jsonka.com. I also want to give a shout out to everybody who took the time to go on Talk Nerdy, or I'm sorry, KaraSantaMaria.com. That's my website. To order cool stuff from the Talk Nerdy store, to listen to the podcast, to download the podcast. And oh, I also want to thank everybody who took the time to go to iTunes or Stitcher and rate or review the podcast. That's a huge help. But I want to give a particular shout out to some individuals who made some really generous donations to the show this week. So first of all, I want to thank Sean Johnson from Mountain View, California. I also want to thank James Talent for your recurring donation. I want to thank Brandy Culberson from Jefferson, Louisiana. A big thank you to Pangea Digital Creation, I'm sure that's the company name, from the Netherlands. Thank you so much for your support of the podcast. I want to thank Kyle Bilheimer from Leesburg, Virginia. I also want to thank James Mitchell for your recurring donation. I want to thank BUA Productions, specifically Doran Whittlesback from St. Louis, Missouri. And, oh, another really generous donation here from Andrew Sanchez in Stephenville, Texas. Thank you so, so much. Also want to thank Cody Hance from Ogden, Utah. And a couple more here. Michael S. Bigelow for your recurring payment. Thank you so much. And lastly, I want to thank Alexander Hertel, another incredibly generous donation right here in Sunnyvale, California. Thank you so much, Alexander, for the support and for the really nice note. And those of you who are doing recurring support through KaraSantaMaria.com and clicking on that button, that takes you to, where does it take you to? Oh, to PayPal. I think that that is a really awesome option, and I'm really happy that you guys take the time to do that. It's really meaningful to me, and you'll be able to continue to do that, but I am thinking about starting a Patreon account, and I asked you guys last week, and I got a lot of really positive feedback. So it's not up and ready yet, but it probably will be up and ready by the next episode, which will be the 50th episode of Talk Nerdy. Absolutely crazy. I can't believe it. So if and when I get that up and running, I will make sure to let you know on the podcast, and you'll start to be able to see exactly where your support of the show goes, what kinds of things that you help me to be able to do to, you know, continue to bring you 100% free content, but also to, you know, show you all the little upgrades and maybe provide some cool sort of members only content for you. So something I've been thinking about, something I'm probably going to do, but I got to get it all set up. All right, I'm sure you're sick of hearing me ramble. I'm really excited about this week's episode. I got to sit down with an incredibly talented writer, singer, composer, and actress named Gia Mora. She has an incredible one-woman show that's called Einstein's Girl. So without further ado, here she is, Gia Mora. Well, Gia, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited because sometimes I feel like the podcast is not just a chance to get my listeners to kind of introduce them to new people, but also a chance to get to know the people that are in my life, but that I haven't really spent much time with and that I want to get to know a little bit better. So just as a little bit of background before we jump into it, I met you through Christina Ochoa, mm-hmm. who has been on the podcast, and also in some ways through Sean Carroll and Jen Ouellette, who have also been on the podcast.
Yes.
So anybody listening already knows them. You're just infiltrating my friend group right now.
It's happening. True. I'm like a virus.
I wasn't even talking about you.
Oh, you mean the listeners. They are too. But
That's amazing. And so I've known you now because we've gone to science soirees and we've kind of hung out at the same time. But I had the amazing opportunity at this last kind of science salon that Jen and actually more Sean and Christina and IQIM, the Institute for Quantum Information and Computing, I think that's what it stands for, at Caltech put on, where Sean talked about I guess the Higgs field. Mm-hmm. Was that really what he talked about?
Yeah,
that was the main focus of the talk.
That it's not a boson, it's really a field.
It's really a field, and we should be focusing on the field. Yeah. Quantum field theory in general. But you did a couple pieces from your one-woman show.
Yeah.
And it was so cool to see that. So I've since then learned, I knew that you were an actress, and I knew that you were a singer, but I didn't realize that you were a composer.
Yeah.
And that's very cool.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about how Einstein's Girl came to be, because I think a lot of times people think about Hollywood actresses and they don't think of them as being very scientifically inclined.
Most definitely. I think the biggest piece of advice, which is terrible advice and I never took it when I first got here, was leave your vocabulary outside the door because you're very threatening. And I have never taken that advice, but it is a very strange set of bedfellows to be both academically inclined and to be here, which of course is why the whole gaggle of people that we have in common they've become my family here, because it's a group of people in Hollywood who have a real sensibility for and a hunger for learning.
Which is not that easy to come across here in LA.
No, definitely not. And I started writing Einstein's Girl almost immediately upon my arrival in Los Angeles because I was bored to tears. I didn't have any friends. I was new. I'd moved from the East Coast. I just chucked everything that I had lived with for 10 years, you know, doing theater all over the East Coast 8 shows a week. And I had become unemployed. And all of a sudden, here I was. What was I going to do? And at that time, there was so much information just flooding the internet about physics and people like Sean having these lectures available. And I started watching that and watching Brian Greene and Michio Kaku and got so excited about it. And my other half, Brad, who's actually here in the other room with us today, he and I started writing back and forth because he was still on the East Coast when I was here. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about all of this and trying to figure out how this worked into our world, which is a completely different world than we lived in. And I was listening to Science Friday in the car on the 405 one night, and Lawrence Krauss was on. And he was talking about a universe from nothing and how sometimes these, you know, universes just appear mm-hmm. out of nowhere. And I thought, oh, that's kind of like a love affair, that sometimes there's just love. It exists, and then it goes away, and then there's another love affair, and it kind of exists. And started reading more about the multiverse and like, oh, well, what if it's these parallel experiences of love? And eventually I came to this idea that you could talk about 21st century romantic relationships in the metaphor of physics. And these two worlds could be woven together into what is essentially a 90-minute stand-up routine punctuated by emotional moments of music. So,
which is absolutely beautiful. And so I think such a smart kind of eureka moment, because I noticed that a lot of writers that I hold near and dear who have sort of conquered an understanding of physics without a strong physics background, like science writers who maybe went up through the ranks in journalism and then learned science in their professional careers, they always say the same thing, is that you have to rely on metaphor mm-hmm. when you're communicating science, especially to a public that doesn't have the background that maybe the scientists that you were interviewing for the piece do. And physics is one of those, especially cosmology and especially like quantum mechanics and places where, you know, what's happening in the universe is really like counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things really necessitate, I think, analogy in a way that maybe biology and some of the sciences that I, my background is in, don't. Because I think I can talk about the brain and people can kind of relate to that because they have a brain, right, and because they've heard these things in popular culture. But when we start talking about, you know, like you said, a universe coming up from nothing, popping into existence and then maybe potentially going away. And that was, I think we might have talked about that a little bit. I had Lawrence Krauss on the podcast a while back. Actually, I don't think we even got into that. I think we spent most of our time talking about the Bicep 2 findings. But that is what his book is about. And I have an old HuffPost video about that idea of a universe from nothing, which is just still to this day hard for me to wrap my head around.
I know. And I think you're exactly right that because everything is counterintuitive to our physical experience when you are talking at a quantum level. Mm-hmm. That the only way, at least to communicate to people outside of the field who can't look at the equations and see what it's saying, because I certainly can't.
Yeah, we don't speak that language.
Right, exactly. And it is a language. Mm-hmm. So when you are not fluent in that language, having the metaphor to rely on, and that's why I've always appreciated Sean so much, because he has this wonderful storytelling quality about him. So having those metaphors makes it so much easier and digestible and understandable and anchors it for people who otherwise would have no other way to kind of remember what they were talking about.
Oh, totally. I mean, when we went to this talk that Sean gave about quantum field theory, the same talk that you sang at, I mean, granted, there's probably a certain percentage of what he said that, like, if you quizzed me the next day, I'd be like, I kind of recognize those words, but I might not be able to fully explain. But there are so many things that when he talks about them, you actually do digest and you swallow, which is a skill beyond all skill. I mean, there are so few people who can successfully balance their time between being a functional working scientist and also communicating science in a way that people like Neil, for example, Neil deGrasse Tyson or Carl Sagan, who after a certain point in their lives were doing science but were much more focused on science communication, or somebody like, not that I would ever put myself in that field, but somebody like myself who does science communication full time, I'm able to put all of my effort into that. But somebody like Sean, he's a scientist. He's an active working scientist.
Yes, and working on huge things like potentially changing the second law of thermodynamics. Yes. I mean, like those kind of monumental breakthroughs that are so far beyond what I can even imagine having in my life.
Yet he can explain it to us in a way that's totally understandable. And so with Einstein's Girl, you kind of, you set out to take some of these things that you were becoming more and more passionate about, that you were learning about in physics, and tell a story, which is obviously very compelling and necessary when we talk about, I think a lot of times people get that. They get that when they come from the outside of science, mm-hmm, and they want to do like media. Maybe they do television shows or they do stage shows. And they understand that the story has to come first, and then the science, you know, should be accurate. But it has to be secondary to the story. It can't be like, this will be about science, so I will read equations to you for the next hour.
Right, because you'll just lose your general audience. And my goal has always been to incite people to explore further.
Exactly.
So much like you said, after we listened to Sean, maybe we couldn't recall with 100% accuracy everything that we had learned. But what we could do is when we went home and read more about it, you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. Ah, that anchors that. Oh, he talked about this. And so you develop a vocabulary of your own working that allows you to kind of interact with something that is beyond your normal set of interactions.
Sure. And really only because you didn't spend 14 years, you know, working on it. Not for any reason other than the fact that that wasn't your focus, you know. And so tell me a little bit about the premise of the story. I mean, who is Einstein's girl?
Well, I think part of what she is an inflated stage version of myself, where everything, my foibles and my eccentricities, get really heightened. And she's someone who's searching for love and searching as a scientifically minded person for an explanation that makes sense, one that isn't just fate or luck or triviality. It's there's got to be a formula that exists in some way. And that's one of the key components to it. If we can split an atom, why can't we figure out a formula to love? And we have all these other pieces in our lives that sort of tell us that there is a formula, like eHarmony saying, you know, more love matches found than anywhere, scientifically proven, all of these kind of pieces. And the misuse of scientific jargon, you know, like I have a major problem with marketing guru people who say things like take a quantum leap when they have no idea what that means. but it sounds like it's scientific. It sounds like it's provable. It sounds like it's replicatable.
Yeah.
And love doesn't appear that way so much to us. There are a lot more pieces to it, much like when Sean was speaking with Marco Iacoboni from UCLA, who's a neuroscientist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he said physics is amazing and mind-blowing, but the brain, we just know so little about. And Sean was in complete agreement with him. He's like, it's really just a big bag of mystery.
Mm-hmm.
So taking these two ideas, one being so mysterious and one being so mathematically concrete, and trying to use them to talk about the other, maybe it gives people a chance to do that. So in the story, you know, taking someone, the Einstein's girl character, and asking her to reconcile these two parts of her world and to see how her empirical understanding of things can either help her accept or help her understand the unacceptable and unexplainable in her life.
And what is that experience like for her? Is she frustrated most of the time? Is she excited? Because I think that this is something that people like you and I can often relate to. And I think probably a lot of my listeners too. There's something intrinsic about being attracted to maybe listening to the types of stories we tell on Talk Nerdy that maybe we are a little bit more evidence-based thinkers, or maybe we are attracted a little bit more towards materialistic thought and things like, well, it's just meant to be.
Right.
Don't really sit well with us, you know? Like, I hate it when people say that. Well, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. It's
right,
like, oh my
right.
God, no, what are you talking about? And you know, when people talk about spirituality, sometimes I'm like, I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
It's such a weird word. And so I understand this kind of compulsive need to quantify everything in my life and to try and understand things that to me, it's just not, you know, satisfactory to say, it's just, we'll never understand it.
Right.
It's just ununderstandable.
Yes.
That to me is like bullshit. Like,
yes.
I don't buy it.
Did you see that big piece? He's on a book tour now. His name has escaped me, but he's the professor of religion and religious studies who had a big piece in The Atlantic last week about how if physics is kind of the paramount of scientific mm-hmm. thought, then when we understand something new in physics, what it only opens is a bigger horizon of questions.
Sure.
And that therefore it's not the answer. And that's why people turn to spirituality, because it gives them an answer. I thought it was this horrendously apologistic
position. Also, that's
position.
Like not why people turn to spirituality. Like, it's because they're so up to speed on physics.
On physics that they've said, well, since there's no answer there, clearly like this holy book has all of the answers.
Ridiculous idea.
It's
no,
terrible.
But it's like he's half there, because when he does say that, you know, every new discovery opens up, you know, an exponentially larger number of questions, that's what's so exciting about science. It's like playing a video game that never ends,
right.
You know, you never reach the end because it just keeps building and building, which is amazing. But that's, no, I mean, I think that there are people who have successfully found a way to reconcile religiosity or spirituality with scientific thought.
Or just compartmentalize them so thoroughly that they
yes,
can
I think a lot
worlds.
Of people do that more so. And I think that in my, as I've kind of moved forward in my approach to science communication, I have changed the way that I talk about religion and that I approach religiosity I don't think it's that I'm becoming more of an apologist by any stretch, because I'm still a, you know, ardent atheist, and I promote atheist ideals, and I'm an atheist activist, and it's very important to me. But I think that what I made the mistake of doing in the past was being so kind of grumpy about my atheism that when I would fundamentally think about what is it that I'm trying to do for a living, Am I trying to reach people in a way that makes them more scientifically curious, or am I trying to reach people in a way that makes them more atheistically curious? And I think that both of those things are important to me, but fundamentally, I want to see a scientifically literate populace.
Sure.
I'm not that interested, or that I don't care that much about seeing an atheistic populace. I want to see a populace that understands secularism and a separation of church and state.
Yes.
But I don't care if other people are atheists. I care that if they are atheists, that their rights are protected. So I realize that in trying to promote scientific thought and scientific literacy, if I was doing it in a way that basically said, you believe in God? That's fucking stupid. That I wasn't going to affect any change. I wasn't going to reach anybody by doing that. And I have in my, in kind of going around the country and talking to a lot of different people, I have met people who, yes, I think more of them do probably compartmentalize. I think that's an important point to make. But I do think that I've met people whose religiosity is so progressive. And so, I mean, they don't believe in a literal translation of the Bible.
Sure.
They're not dogmatic about these things, but they find a lot of, meaning and truth in religious texts, and they feel personally that they are religious people, but it's not in any direct conflict to science. I think some people manage that. I don't think it's many, but I think some do. And I think that I don't want to continue to make the mistake of kind of belittling or marginalizing the people that do that, because I'm just concerned about the fact that they're pro science,
right?
You know what I mean,
right?
And how do you feel living in LA? I guess I have to ask you, because you've been here longer than I have. I'm assuming, how long have you lived here? Quite a while.
2 years.
Oh, never mind. Yeah. So you were in New York first. Which did you grow up in New York?
No, I grew up in Colorado.
Okay, but you grew up to parents that were, like, in the arts, right?
Yes, my dad is a guitar player, a phenomenal guitar player. But my dad falls on the opposite end of the spectrum as far as all the other stuff goes, that he is Mr. Woo, Mr.
Not uncommon.
Yeah, you know. And in a weird and wonderful way, though, he, at 60-some years old now, has this new career in music, not playing music on the road or doing those kind of things that he's done forever and ever, but he does music therapy in hospital and hospice settings. And so for him, it's this wonderful conflation of his love of music and his love of the spirituality, right?
Sure.
Which is so ultimately my dad.
Yeah.
You know, my dad would not be my dad were it not for this component of his personality. And he's very zen about the whole thing. My mother's always said he'd be thrilled if he had a cardboard box and a guitar, that's all he needs to really live.
Aww.
But that's him. And yet when I talk with him about the research that I'm learning, you know, and I say research, as I don't mean in any way that I'm doing research. I'm doing it for my show, for my own selfish
sure
edification. But he almost always will try and defer back to his other sort of explanations. And what I think is interesting and what I hope to accomplish, much like what you're talking about with my show, is that the conversation gets started and that maybe we can see more similarities between these worlds than differences, because it's so easy to stand on the defensive, especially when you firmly believe in something. And I was just saying to Brad the other day about like hard stance on gay marriage, that I just have no tolerance for people who can't see that what someone does privately in their own lives doesn't affect them
at all.
Period.
Yeah.
You know, or pro-life. Well, I'm as pro-life as the next person, but you know, I don't want it to affect the life of the mother. Oh, so the happiness, the well-being, the comfort, that's irrelevant. I feel terrible because I want to be more understanding. I want to be more compassionate. And yet there are just things in my life that I'm so hard line about. And so I hope that what I'm doing when I do the show is asking other people to maybe not be so hard line, to maybe take it, at least to take perspective on it, because you cannot get anywhere if you're in constant traction with the other side. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it doesn't serve the culture at large. And it certainly doesn't promote tolerance, which is what we all desperately need.
And I think the thing that's, I mean, and maybe I'm not correct in my assumption when it comes to, let's say, some of these more intractable views, especially about things like gay marriage and like pro-lifers, like insane pro-lifer. I watch documentary after documentary, it's so depressing, about these kinds of issues, and oftentimes in middle America. And I guess the thing that bothers me the most about having these kinds of intractable views is that they often don't seem to have been born out of a cultural and emotional relationship with religion. I think more often than that, they really are born out of a political stance that is calculated.
Oh, yeah.
It's a specific calculated idea about these third rail issues and a real means of kind of in some ways social control.
Oh, yes.
Powers that be with a lot of money make decisions about kind of approaching these issues instead of paying attention to the issues that should matter more on a political spectrum, like healthcare and
economics,
education.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that these are things that people can cling to and become passionate about and continue to divide the country. And the sad thing is, it's like they're being duped. Like they're heavily being duped, and it's often not by their pastors. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you find it heavily in the church community. But even then, it does seem like the rhetoric there is a bit tainted by political means. These
sure.
are the pastors that are being paid exorbitant amounts of money.
And they are contributing exorbitant amounts of money to campaigns.
Exactly. And I guess my eyes were kind of opened up to that a little bit more when I finally, and I know it was like so late to the game, maybe about 6 months ago or something, watched Jesus Camp on Netflix.
Oh, that movie.
I know. Ooh. And I didn't realize what it was really about when I first saw it. I always had it in my queue and I was like, it's going to be depressing because it's going to be about these sad little brainwashed kids who love Jesus and who are really emotional about it. And then I realized, no, these are kids who are going to a camp that's like politically inclined to promote these kind of heavily Christian radical right ideals that have very little to do with Christianity.
Yeah, nothing in the scriptures.
Exactly.
Nothing.
And everything to do with hard right Republican
scare
social
tactics.
Control. Yeah, exactly. And that's such a bummer, you know, yeah. because I feel like the truth of the matter is most people out there aren't like that. This is a small sliver. It's a small fraction that gets a lot of media attention.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the lunatic fringe does tend to get a lot of attention. That's
And part of the reason why is that even though it's the tiniest fraction of actual individuals who are going to the voting booths, it's a major, major component of people who actually have political power. And that becomes really scary, I think, as we try to affect change at the level, at the kind of civic level,
yeah.
but we're fighting against these exorbitant amounts of money with these really intense political ideas about who should be making decisions. You know,
right.
we all saw that Ted Cruz is now in heading up the committee that has ultimate control over like NASA's
yeah.
budget.
Well, appointing Orrin Hatch is just beyond devastating.
It's insane. And you look at the House Science Committee, and
yes.
I guess they recently changed the names like on space and something.
Right.
But so many of these people are climate deniers.
Absolutely, publishing books with that title. I mean, it's, and then you couple that with, like you said, sort of the mainstream Republican response to the State of the Union by Joni Ernst,
mm-hmm.
managed somehow to say, and we believe in life, as if that had anything to do with what Obama had said at all. None
exactly.
at all. Whether you like the president or not, you're like, well, that's definitely a tangential thought that has
yes.
nothing to do with it. And then you have people like Rand Paul who are just outright irresponsible. And I feel like Duke needs to revoke his MD, because he has in the past couple of weeks not only said things that are just outrageously dangerous considering we have a measles epidemic happening in California, to
mm-hmm.
say that he's heard of mental retardation after
immunization. Yeah, he just pulled that out of his ass. Like,
Michelle Bachmann,
the
right, you understand when Crazy Eyes says it, because she has nothing, but she doesn't have anything to legitimize her idiocy.
Exactly.
He does.
Yeah,
that's
a lot of people really
scary.
Respect Rand Paul.
Absolutely.
Because they look at him as kind of the new way to be semi-conservative, because he's a true libertarian.
It's true.
And a lot of academics and a lot of kind of, I think, progressive thinkers identify more with libertarianism. But the problem is that he still has these holdover ideas from batshit Republican kind of, I don't know, like rhetoric.
Right.
And that's actually even more than that, because I think that a lot of people who are pro-vaccine are actually conservative. I think that this is just like Rand Paul being fucking crazy.
Right. Well, and then this latest thing, did you hear about how twice in 1 week he said he had a degree in biology and English, which is not true. He was studying biology and English, but he never graduated with an undergraduate degree.
Oh, my God.
But that his people have said, well, he has an MD, and that is the study of biology. But, of course, the academic world has said, not at all.
It's not a research degree.
No. So, that these people who have spotlights and who say these things, I find it so dangerous and so scary. And like you said, this minority of people has a great amount of power, politically speaking. And it is really terrifying as someone like, what are my nephews going to grow up with in a world where these kind of people get talk time, they get airtime.
Exactly. And the thing is, you're not going to, so you're every man on the street who's watching, late night talk shows and who watches the 7 o'clock? There's no 7 o'clock news, is there?
I don't know.
I don't know what time the news
does
comes
someone
on.
Watch television? I know people
watch the news on TV still. But everybody who is kind of who's getting these things passively by watching the news or reading, in their Twitter feed, think about the proportion of people who hear that one statement that Rand Paul makes about how vaccines are dangerous and it should be your choice as a parent to vaccinate your children, because who knows, maybe they'll be retarded after you vaccinate them, versus Seth Mnookin's book, The Panic Virus, which is a really balanced and even approach to the conversation about the 1998 Wakefield study in The Lancet that was published that showed a link between vaccines and autism, that was then refuted, then actually pulled from The Lancet.
Yep.
Then he lost all sorts of accreditations and he
couldn't, his license,
yeah, all of his licenses. And as we all know in science journalism, it's very easy. The rumor mill starts churning, and it's very easy for something that sounds believable and something that is kind of digestible to go viral like wildfire, but the retraction never goes viral.
Doesn't.
So we still have people who go, well, yeah, but don't vaccines cause autism? And you're like, oh my God, Jenny McCarthy.
I know.
Like, I know. It's so frustrating. And so to see people perpetuate that, it's disappointing that the people who have the platform are sometimes the people who are the most irresponsible to be communicating, and the people who have the knowledge and the people who have the balanced kind of, and really I think oftentimes literarily astute ways to talk about these things are just kind of, not that they're silenced, they're just kind of having to scream against everybody in the inner circle,
yeah,
who just has a microphone for like, why the fuck do you have a microphone? Because your dad had a microphone? Like,
right.
Is that, it's frustrating.
Well, and I think it speaks to this interesting double-edged sword of science in general, which is, because you mentioned Bicep 2, right? Which, mm-hmm, they've said, never mind, that wasn't exactly what we were looking at.
Yeah.
But the great thing about science is that it continues to ask itself, is this still true? Do we continue to have evidence of this? Do we continue to see these laws in action? And that is the entire basis of scientific theory. It's like, I feel like every ninth grader needs to be sat down just for 3 days solid and drilled into them about what scientific theory means.
Yes.
And that it means that it is a literal evolution of understanding that changes. And not that it always changes in a forward progression. It's just an evolution. It is a change.
Yeah, it's not a goal-oriented.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that sort of ivory tower kind of, this is the law, right? This is gravity. It is 9.8 meters per second squared, blah, blah, blah. We, as a culture, think these are immutable, mm-hmm, and that there's no constant need for those to always prove to reflect the theories behind them. And because of that, then people use that as a manipulation, politically speaking, to say, well, but look, this Bicep 2, they said they found the cosmic microwave background. I can't even talk, but
yeah. No.
And then they go, they retracted it. So how could it? It's likely that this Wakefield study that was retracted probably shouldn't have been. So they use it as
like
a backwards justification. Yeah.
Or like, okay, I have to bring this up, and I don't hate to do it. I feel like I feel a responsibility to do it, although in my personal life, I do hate to do this a little bit. So I was recently watching real time. It might have been last week's or it might have been the weeks before. And it was a huge bummer for me because anybody at this point, it's been long enough. Anybody who Googles me knows that I used to date Bill Maher. I dated him for 3 years when I first moved to LA and we were very close. And he's a lovely, lovely man. And we're still, you know, very close. And I respect him so much. And I respect his positions on atheism. And I respect all of the things that he's accomplished in his life. I do think that he has done some things that are a bit irresponsible, especially lately. And I feel like I would be remiss to not even bring it up, this conversation that we've been having about vaccines. And I think that this is a good example mm-hmm. of where this stuff can kind of go awry, even with somebody who is plainly trying to be on the right side of history and trying to understand these things, but without a strong scientific background, because academically speaking, it's not a requisite. Like people right. don't. Well, first of all, I'm going to backtrack like 1,000 times. First of all, I just spent a little bit of time in Houston this week at the University of Houston speaking with the math department, and I met some amazing undergrads and graduate students and so many cool girls, so many underrepresented minorities. And that's what we were talking about a lot there, is getting more women and minorities involved in STEM. But I also had a lot of really interesting conversations with the professor who invited me. And one of the things that we kept coming back to is this idea that it's not required at the high school level that anybody take philosophy.
Right.
It's not required that people understand scientific theory, what the scientific method is, for example. Right. And when they learn science, they learn it as just like a chain of facts.
Right.
Which is the exact wrong way to be thinking about science and philosophy. Ultimately, if you go back far enough, we're the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. You go back to Democritus, Lucretius, all of those things.
And math, too.
Sure.
All of those things were the same thing.
And again, ironically, with math, like here in the Dark Ages, the Arab world kept math alive, progressing it, all these things. And that was intertwined very closely with religion there. I mean, all of the geometric configurations in
and
mosques,
you see it
all
too
of those things.
In really Orthodox Jewish culture.
Yes, absolutely.
How important
numerism
mathematics is.
And all of that. Yes. Absolutely.
And it's funny because when those things weren't fully teased apart, it was like just understood that this is the big questions about where we came from and about how we quantify the world were fundamental to anybody who was lucky enough to have an education. They were fundamental to their education. And now we're so focused on job skills and we're so focused on applications that the pure stuff, the pure math, the pure science for the sake of science kind of gets ignored. So that being said, I will say that I think that sometimes I get pissy when I'm like, oh, so irresponsible to say that on camera. It's so irresponsible to say. And then I'm like, wait, what kind of education did this person have? Where is their train of thought? Where does it come from? The scientific literacy has to go back a little bit deeper.
Sure.
So,
but as in your defense, Maher the other day, I don't know if it was that same episode you watched, but one of the only conservative guest who was on there actually tried to argue that the three dissident papers of the 10,852 climate change papers that have said it's real and it's man-made mm-hmm. and we all have to pay attention, that he actually tried to say that those three dissenters were the equivalent of Galileo dissenting from scientific thought and saying yes. that we don't live in a heliocentric world. It was like, what?
Yes.
You realize that science didn't really exist in the form that we're talking about then, that he was literally talking against the Catholic Church. Like
against everybody.
Yeah.
Yes. Against like everything that and that is history told us what an effect Galileo had. History, you know, as we moved forward as a culture and as science moved forward, they go, oh, he was fucking right about this and about that and about this and about that. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen with the climate dissenters. No. And you can't make that kind of irresponsible statement until or unless you get that kind of evidence in your pocket 10, 20, 30, 100, 5,000 years later. So that's incredibly irresponsible. But on the same episode. So what I would say is that those kinds of arguments were very politically motivated.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Sometimes,
talking points.
Yes,
purely.
Talking points. But when I look at Bill's arguments, I don't know if they're necessary. And this is the what some people would say is a straight anti-vax rhetoric. I don't know if they're necessarily politically motivated or if they come from a place of confusion and ignorance, mm-hmm. trying to reconcile a very complicated topic, which is what I see a lot, is that people are distrustful of pharmaceutical industries.
Sure.
Which is fair. and reasonable. But they conflate that with being distrustful of science.
Yes.
And then they throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it worries me so much when I see people, especially Hollywood types, who are devoutly focused on alternative treatments and alternative medicine and holistic medicine, and the rhetoric that comes along with that that's not based in academic science, to the point where they throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to real medical intervention. Yet these are often the same people where if something really bad happens, they're going to take an antibiotic.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And so my concern was that the argument that he was making on the show, he was saying, yes, we all need to get a measles vaccine. Of course we do. Nobody's arguing against that. And of course we all know that polio was eradicated because of Jonas Salk, and that was really important. And it's really sad that measles was basically eradicated in this country and now it's back. But the flu vaccine... And that's where I started to get a little bit like uncomfortable. And eventually I kind of had to turn the episode off. So I don't even really know what happened at the end of it. But a lot of the arguments that he was trying to make, the flu vaccine's bullshit, right? Because we know that this year, for example, it hardly protected anybody against the flu. And it's like, and nobody stopped and said to him, no, listen, the flu mutates.
Yes.
It's a virus that mutates all the time. And in order to get enough vaccine available for the next coming flu season, physicians and epidemiologists have to kind of do a little bit of like magician kind of try and see the future Nosferatu bullshit.
Right?
Not Nosferatu. That's the wrong guy. What's the other guy?
No, Nostradamus.
Nostradamus.
The other end guy. I like
it's
the idea of
vampiric.
Of yeah, exactly. I like that. It's Boris Karloff working with the CDC.
That's amazing. Nostradamus bullshit, where they look at trends and then they say this seems to be most likely it's going to be a bird type flu or it's going to be a swine type flu,
right,
and
right.
It's going to have this kind of structure, and
right.
let's develop a vaccine against it. Sometimes they're spot on. Sometimes they're not.
Look at HPV. Same kind of deal.
Exactly.
There's
different strains. We protect against the ones that we think are going to be the most likely to hit. But what people don't realize, and what's never said, but it's so important to be said, is that the reason you should vaccinate against the flu every year is because you build up immunity to those strains. And that immunity lasts like almost, I think, close to a decade.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
So if you get every vaccine every year, then 3 years from now, when something hits that maybe the majority of people weren't vaccinated against, you might have residual immunity to that. And that's really important. And so these are the kinds of things where we're lacking nuance in the conversation. I think that oftentimes we are so extreme. It's human nature, too, to
sure,
think black and white.
And do you think it's also... symptomatic of a soundbite culture that
that
nuance it takes time to understand it and time to deliver it,
and it's hard to do that when you have a 60-second news hit with a
sure.
headset on. I mean, I do sometimes think that I get a little bit frustrated, especially with Bill's situation, because he has a platform and he has a full hour, and I know the way that the show is run. I used to date him. I was there. I would go to the show every week, and I know that he has a lot of control. You know, he has executive producers,
sure.
but he doesn't even wear an earpiece, which is very uncommon. Like, I've done live television shows where you have to wear an earpiece. He's lucky he doesn't have to throw to commercial and keep to time in that respect, but he has to keep the show to time, and he really just relies on cues over the cameras of like, maybe now is the time when we move on to the next segment. But there's no 3-2-1 off air, which is what I'm used to dealing
sure.
with. So in some ways, if he wants to talk about something for longer, he can,
and they'll just throw it to overtime
exactly.
if they need to.
He can. He can say, I'm going to push this next conversation about ISIS because I think that this conversation about vaccinations is more important. So in some ways, in that respect, I do. I'm bummed out about it, but I totally agree. We live in a soundbite culture. We live in a culture where you can find the answer right away,
right.
but where complexity in the answer is something that we don't value.
Sure. And I think there's much too, it's a weird thing to say there's too much trust in the Google, but seriously, people will Google something and it's the first hit, whatever the first hit is, they believe is gospel.
And we know that Google knows you, right? We know
of
at
course.
This point, like,
it's going to give you what you want.
Exactly.
Hear.
Like, watch Colin Hoback's amazing documentary, Terms and Conditions May Apply.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So good. Teaches you all about the balance between privacy and convenience. And we know that it's in being logged into Google. In being like having a Gmail account, being on YouTube, all of these things are linked to Google, and being logged in, they know your preferences. It, the algorithms know what you regularly search. So as you start to search things more and more, you're going to get hits that are customizable for you. So if you're a climate denier and you surround yourself in a climate denialism echo chamber, you're going to get hits that
support your view.
Exactly. Yeah. And then that's just going to keep being reinforced. We can, because we are so, because information is so readily available, which is a huge blessing.
Yes.
We also have turned it in some ways into a curse because there is so much information now. We can completely live in a self-contained and self-built bubble of the news that's right for me, mm-hmm. which isn't really even news.
Right. But that may be the Fox slogan. Do you know what I mean? Like news that caters to what you already think is true.
Exactly. And we say, and it's easy for us to throw mud and say Fox News, but like MSNBC is not much better.
No. I mean, as someone who tries to read as much foreign press as possible mm-hmm. for perhaps a more, a less biased view of American politics, it's hard because, everybody has their camp because they're also in the business of making money.
Exactly. So even when you're reading in the foreign press, whenever we're reading things about Israel and Palestine, everything's biased. Absolutely. Everything's biased depending on who wrote it, depending on what the country is, its country of origin, and whether that person has similar political views to their country or revolutionary political views to their country. It's just very hard on an issue like that to find balanced coverage.
Yeah. And I find the older I get, like the more I'm rejecting these bourgeois kind of sentiments that I think as you age, we're sort of expected to grow up and do all of these things that really put you as part of the commercial machine and the consumerist machine of America. And the older I get, the more I want to reject all of that. And it's hard because I like companies like Google.
Yeah, of course. But I don't know what I would do without Google.
Right, but we are inherently in their pocket.
Yeah.
We
give them permission.
We absolutely sign over. And we have, what's the South Park, the Scent iPad episode. Have you seen that?
I never saw it.
Oh my God.
I haven't been watching South Park
lately,
but it's so good. Okay.
It's amazing because it's all about the agreeing to the terms and conditions of iTunes and that every 2 seconds you're asked to update your iTunes and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, you didn't actually read that. So
no,
here's what you agree. Here, Stan from South Park, this is what you actually agreed to. And it's so weird because having the accessibility of the information is very important to me. But I know that it comes at a real cost. And there's been that argument, does having the internet make smart people smarter or make dumb people dumber? And I think there's legitimate arguments to be made in support and against that statement.
Yeah. I think that's one of those things that there's a lot of media coverage asking that question. And we're still trying to square that circle and figure it out.
Right.
Yes, obviously, we are different,
right?
Because of the accessibility that we have. I think how that's going to change our culture in the long run is still to be determined. But we can look at measurable changes, like right now, and it's a huge advantage. But there are negative things that come with it. I like to look at it that way. It's a positive, and it's trending in the positive direction. But there are things that are really fucked up that we have to work through in order to keep going positive. I definitely don't look at like technology as though it's evil.
No,
intrinsically evil.
Exactly. That's the key of it because everything is in use.
Yes, it's all in how and lots of times it's like let's go back to what we're really talking about, which is profit motive.
Right.
And which is lobbyism and government. And this is why conversations like net neutrality are so fucking important.
Yes.
And everybody talks about them. But like, I don't see people getting as...
Not at the dinner table.
Exactly.
You really think that's that's the problem.
Yeah, I don't know if like my parents, if I were like, let's talk about net neutrality, they might be like, I'm not sure what that is.
Right. What is throttling?
Exactly. But it's like, that is just such an obvious and concrete and easy to grasp way to see that... There is a conversation on the table about whether or not the internet should be free for everybody and whether or not certain companies should be able to make money off of you being able to access content.
Right.
And that's one of those things, just like we have to, check yes on the terms and conditions with Google. Can you imagine when we have to pay Google?
Right.
Or when we have to pay Verizon to let us access Google?
Right.
Like that's...
But I mean, here's the weird thing, because now... The internet is essentially a utility. It's as ubiquitous as electricity and water and heat and gas and all those things. And there are private companies that have essentially monopolies on those utilities.
Yes. It's so infuriating. Like, don't we have antitrust laws? Like, aren't we supposed to be able to do that?
I know, but we're living in a robber baron era. Again, it's a 100-year cycle, don't you think? I mean, it's a little scary to imagine that being true. And, you know, in the same way that we still have people who starve to death and die and freeze in the streets, we still have people who are, you know, dying informationally, who don't have access to it. And when, you know, textbook companies have monopolies, that's a terrifying thing too. And so then when to go back to the Marr point that, mm-hmm. you know, to take a skepticism toward profit motive, I appreciate. And that sort of bohemian part of me that's, you know, a rebel. And when I lived in D.C., I protested all the time. We protested the Iraq War. We protested, yeah. all those kind of stuff. And, you know, that's very, very important to me. But if you can't access the information to even know what's out there, I mean, it just becomes this really complicated capitalist issue.
It's a huge issue that has, that unfortunately, every time we have these kinds of conversations, I think we just keep coming back to campaign finance reform.
I know.
Keep coming back to the fact that politicians are funded by big corporations.
Yep.
And as long as we allow that to be the norm,
yes.
these issues are going to continue to happen.
Having these short election cycles, I think, is also extremely damaging because people aren't interested in talking about climate change as a long-term thing because they only are thinking 4 to 6 years in advance and whether or not they'll be reelected.
That's so true. You know, we have a hard time in this country thinking about a generation from now.
Absolutely.
We're very short-sighted. And I think it's promoted for many reasons. It's promoted in government because of short election cycles. It's promoted in our everyday lives because we don't have to wait for anything.
No.
It's like drive-thrus and Google searches and, you know, direct deposit, and everything's really immediate.
Yeah.
And it's very hard for us to sometimes sit back and kind of disconnect and think about, well, what's it going to be like in 20, 30, 40 years? And it's funny because, like, I don't have kids and I don't want kids. Like, I don't think I'm ever going to be a mom. And so of anybody, I think somebody like me should kind of care the least. But for some reason, I care a lot. And I get really pissed when I see people who have, like, children and their children have children making decisions where I'm like, you're fucking poisoning this planet for the people that you physically made. Like, what a fucked up thing to do to those
kids.
Right,
right.
Like,
and they're under some probably unintentional on their part illusion that uh-huh. what they're doing isn't doing that to their kids.
Like, and granted, we do it too. We all have this cognitive dissonance, and I hear
yes.
about it from my listeners all the time, and I appreciate it. I drive an electric car, and I'm sitting here in LA going, oh yeah, I'm doing my part. I drive an electric car. I'm such a badass. Give me a burger. Like, right. I eat so much fucking meat. Like, that's not good. That's really bad for the environment, you know?
But you get to a point too. I have a very good friend who's a plant-based nutritionist and author, and he struggles on a daily basis because at a certain point, being alive and living in a first world country means you consume resources. And it means mm-hmm. you consume resources at an exponential level compared to pretty much anyone else in the world.
Yeah.
And you will never find sort of peace at saying, well, I drive my car, but I eat a burger, or, mm-hmm. you know, I buy American-made products, but they have plastic packaging, or I want to eat completely plant-based, but the hemp seeds that I get have been shipped from Guatemala.
Yeah.
Whereas I could just eat from my local farm, but then that would be endangering the chicken who's laid the egg. Who, blah, blah. Yeah, I mean, you just go down a rabbit hole of self-hatred.
And there are so many. We live in a culture now where there's so many things to be frustrated by. Like you said, the plastic packaging, the factory farming, the massive consumption of oil and gas, the slave labor that goes into making.
Yes.
And you're like, I want to vote with my dollar, and every decision that I make makes me complicit in
whatever
these kinds of decisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at the same time, the culture is built up in such a way that you accidentally are complicit, even if you're one of these activist types who's like really intentionally working hard, like never buy consumer single use
right.
plastics and never buy it. You can't. It's like that episode of Portlandia where it's like, can we go meet the chicken
right.
to see his like how good his life was? Like at a certain point, it would take that kind of due diligence. And the frustrating thing for me is that it's kind of left on our shoulders as consumers instead of seeing across the board governmental regulation. Right. I want to see single-use plastics banned.
Yeah.
That's the only way they're not going to be used anymore is if somebody says, somebody, you know. If
right. There is a law. There is an amendment. You can't do it
the same way we banned plastic bags in California.
Right.
That's huge. That's a huge thing that we did.
Absolutely.
If we can ban plastic bottles, that'll be even huger.
Yes.
Because I buy plastic bottles still. I don't want to, and I choose not to most of the time. I am addicted to Coca-Cola. I drink it too much. I want to quit. I only buy Coca-Cola in glass and cans. I don't buy in plastic bottles because I have the option.
Right.
I can't always find water in box, like box water.
Right, right.
And, you know, it's hard to find. Like, you can find it out here on the coast, but people who are listening from, like, Idaho are like, what the fuck is box water?
Yeah. It's like a milk box, but filled with water.
Exactly. It's great. It's great. And you know, when I'm in production now, I make sure that the crew, like, we all drink out of, like, different colored Nalgene bottles.
Oh, so
and
smart.
We refill because production is super wasteful. But at the same time, I can't control that on every production.
I know. I had a heart attack the other day. I was shooting on a major network TV show, and I was just looking at the amount of just like scraping off of the, the thing. And I was like,
they throw away all the craft
I'm
services.
Out.
Yeah.
Freaking
so
out.
Much
and,
food.
And I felt so guilty. I felt like, what have I done? Like,
yeah.
At least when I was doing theater, I felt like.
It's because you guys were poor, right? When you're doing theater, you don't have any money, so
well,
you have to be scrappy.
I should say that, yeah. I mean, like, theater actors definitely are not making LA money.
And just
money.
Theater productions, too. They're, like, scrimping just to make, so it's...
Yes, except that I was in, like, super high-budget million-dollar plus things, like $4 or $5 million productions. So there was
so they're
definitely
still wasting
ways.
Food and shit.
But yeah. In a different way, because the longevity of a project is longer. You know what
yeah,
I mean? Like,
that's
every day
true.
Of production in film and television is new, and it's moving. It's consume,
yeah.
change. If you're doing a 6-month run of a Shakespeare play at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C., it's just there. I mean, they built the set. It will eventually be either repurposed or recycled or thrown away.
Yeah.
But at least it lives for 6 months. It doesn't live for 6 hours,
that's
which is
so true.
The consumption time frame in television.
That's so true. Like, I guess I did my live daily show, which is when I was on Take Part Live, is probably my best experience, other than, like, going to Bill's show, my best experience with a really large production that's not out in the field. Most of the work I do is field work. So a large production on a set with hair and makeup and with, like, a full crew, you
right.
know, all the grips and gaffers and, like, all of the crafty that's, but it was still like a set crew, you know, is we were live every day.
Right.
So for the most part, it was the same sound guy every day. It was the same, you know,
right.
Whatever every day, but I would still see just, like, huge amounts of waste. And we even were really conscientious. So actually we might not have wasted the way that other people do, because I think that we got hooked up with this really great, nonprofit in California. And I have no idea what their name is, but I think there's more than one who do this, that basically work with productions to come and take all of the leftover crafty.
So great.
Yeah. And bring it to soup kitchens
yeah.
and bring it to places so that people can eat
yes,
it.
Because with all the food stamp cuts, especially in California,
exactly.
there have been so many people going hungry, and these food banks have nothing to give.
Yes. And the fact that people are having to dumpster dive when there are, like, they must hit the jackpot outside of, like, Paramount or
yeah,
something
exactly.
like that, when they dumpster dive and they find, like, a massive craft services tray full of, like, hors d'oeuvres or something, or, like, you know, it's like tacos just forever. There's, like, 10
yeah,
packages
yeah.
of tacos.
6 miles of Subway.
Exactly. It's like, well, fuck, let's bring this to the place where the people
right,
need it.
Throwing it into the trash.
Literally into the trash.
And the thing, and I, you know, I know there are these restricting laws that say you can't give food that's been sitting out to people because there's a health hazard. I
yeah.
totally understand, like, but that's an example of, like, regulation biting itself in the ass.
And it's also an example, I think, of people not planning well enough. If
no.
you know that there's a law, then keep it heated the whole time. And as soon
right,
as you're
it
done,
covered. Keep it do it. Yeah,
cover
arrange
it and put it in the fridge.
And have somebody there. Because somebody from an organization that's a nonprofit will be there with their car revving.
And that's
second,
what they do.
And
yeah.
they do.
They come. They show up right at the time that you tell them craft services are over. They come and
yeah.
they get the food, and it's still hot when
exactly.
they take it back.
So it takes planning. And I think, in general, this is this other dichotomy that we live in, instant gratification and very necessary planning to deal with the consequences of that immediate gratification.
Yes. I mean, the luckier that we get, the more that we have access to things that make our lives easier, I think in some ways we should be taking the amount of mental energy and the amount of time and the amount of effort that we used to historically have to spend on cooking, now that we can just go through a drive-through, or right. on, you know, doing our research now that we can just Google something really quickly. We need to take that and think about how we can be affecting change for the good. Think about all of the negative consequences that come along with these things. We have the time. We don't need to just keep, every time we have some, we find a new technology that makes our lives easier. Like, I have a Roomba. I don't, but I want one. I have a Roomba, so now I never have to vacuum again. Well, before I found the time to fucking vacuum. So if I had the time to vacuum, I shouldn't fill that in with something else that shows, oh, now I just still don't have any time.
Right.
It's like, no, now that I don't have to vacuum, I have that small amount of free time to go out in nature and try and appreciate these things, right. or to contribute to the, you know, the work that I'm doing, volunteering, yes. or just to become more aware of that. You know, sometimes activism or getting involved in something really comes down to just watching documentaries and reading news articles and trying to change your mindset a little bit, because that's the first thing.
Sure.
Is to be aware. Yeah. And then you can start actually really affecting change. Yeah. And those of us who live maybe on the best coast. no, but really those of us who do live in coastal communities, those of us who live in richer cities, those of us who have access to, yes, a higher standard of living in many ways. And granted, some of us struggle too, because that also means everything else is more expensive. Mm-hmm. But our lives might be a little bit easier. And because our lives are a little bit easier, we should take that into consideration. And we should say, you know, I'm lucky because of this. How can I give back?
But there,
instead of I deserve this.
Yes. And I think that when you look at the 1% and the plutocratic uber billionaires who have so much wealth that they, you know, three people make what 85% of the rest of the world does, kind of thing, mm-hmm. that they don't report, number one, believing that they are wealthy or rich or feel like they are privileged, which is a weird sort of, again, compartmentalization of reality.
Super
like,
weird.
What? You do drive on the street. Oh, no, you don't. Never mind.
Exactly.
You fly in your private jet to Whole Foods or not even that. I don't know, to your masseur. I don't know what you do. But that there is, it's a fine line between sort of accepting your privilege. And I mean, that's been a big question of late too, you know, this idea of privilege in general, you know, accepting your privilege, knowing what it gives you, and then recognizing sort of in Spider-Man terms, the responsibility that you've now been endowed with.
Exactly. And I think that we do see some people out there. We see some very famous people like Warren Buffett who understand, like Bill Gates, who, and most, I will give you this, most filthy rich people give back way more than anybody else. They do philanthropy and they pay a lot of fucking taxes.
Yes.
Like, but at
but
the
not
same
nearly
time,
as much as they did in 1975.
Exactly.
And not nearly like as much they would pay in Europe.
And not nearly as much as the tax code really does ask them to pay. They find the loopholes.
Absolutely.
And a lot of times they do these things legally. And this is an issue where at a certain point, do we blame them or do we blame the relationship between money and politics that allowed those loopholes to be in place in the first place? So I do respect and really admire people who are in a position where they are able to give back, for giving back as much as they do. I think the issue is, like you said, this idea of like, I'm lucky or I'm privileged is getting lost on some people, which is problematic. And we can talk about that at different income levels.
Oh, even sure.
Even like in impoverished areas, a white guy might have a harder time saying, well, I have privilege over, you know, my friends that are black or over the women in my neighborhood. And that can be difficult. On top of that, I think that, first of all, we have to learn how to understand and how to accept and say, it's okay that I'm privileged, but I want to, like you said, use that responsibility for good. And I think that culturally, we need to be moving away from this idea of like somehow really hard work equals riches.
Right.
That American dream idea that is perpetuated on the right, that is really dangerous psychologically for a lot of people, because most of the people that work the hardest don't do the best.
No, it isn't a meritocracy as much as we'd like for it to be so.
And a lot of the people that are doing as well as they are doing, yes, don't get me wrong, they worked hard, but they usually started
from a different place.
Yeah, they had a handicap. They many times come from families where they had money to be able to get them started, or they didn't have to pay for their university training.
Right, or they had connections, or they had support while they were innovating, or they had whatever. There was that huge study that came out of Johns Hopkins, that 20-year longitudinal study about changing your economic bracket.
Sure.
Over the course
of the idea
of
social mobility.
Right.
And that we think that we have so much social mobility.
And
in
there's
this
country. No, at least in that longitudinal study, there's absolutely no evidence of it.
Yeah.
And it got worse, you know, the more, the less privilege you had, the worse it got.
Oh, yeah. If you are living in poverty, it is
almost impossible, ever think
to get
that
out of
even
poverty.
In a generation or two that you'll ever raise out of that.
Exactly. And the reason that I bring this up and the reason that we're talking about it right now is not to make people
feel guilty.
Yeah, or to make them give up. It's not to make them go, oh, well, if I'm never going to get out of this station, what should I do? It's to think about the fact that we have developed a culture that is perpetuating these issues. So what we need to do is not, it's not on the individual to work harder and try more and get out. It's on us to think a little bit more collectively and to start making policy changes and to start being more involved at the civic level to change the things that will improve social mobility.
Yes.
It's to support the groups. It's to support the scholarships and the different ways that we can help, you know, young ethnic minority students go to college. The different ways that we can, you know, when people argue with me about affirmative action, it just makes me sick that they're like, they get so mad. Like, what about people who wouldn't deserve that position and they got it anyway just because they had to get like a 10% black enrollment or something? It's like, fuck you, you're not doing your research.
No,
fuck you, there's enough candidates out there that
are
viable.
My God. Absolutely.
And if
show that after 5 years, they're doing as well or better than their peers.
Exactly. And if you can't find, you know, a black candidate for your position, it's because you're not fucking looking hard enough.
No.
That's why.
You haven't expanded your search. It's
exactly.
Ridiculous.
And I'm a huge advocate of affirmative action, and I think it has to be in place. And all of these different social programs for people who are underprivileged have to be in place until we don't need them anymore. But we obviously still fucking need them, because study after study shows that social mobility is shit in this company.
Yep.
Income inequality is higher than it's almost ever been. And we see that women still make 22% less than men for doing the same jobs. Black women, actually Hispanic women, make the least, then Hispanic men, then black women, then black men, all the way up to whites. And actually, weirdly, in certain positions, Asian men and women do the best, which is kind of strange. But we we definitely need to be wary of these things, and we need to be trying to affect change in these things until I think the change actually occurs.
Right.
And until then, we can't stand back and go like, racism is over.
Right. It's ridiculous
it's like
to say so.
Fucking stupid.
And it, I know, and I understand one of the challenges is that we're looking at a continually changing demographic in this country. That there's a piece in the New Yorker this week about Scandinavia and about how their social programs are, you know, so much more forward looking. And there's, even though there's disagreement and there's diversity within their political parties, that the lean is far more in favor of the society at large, as opposed to the triumphant individual, which is so American in its ideal. But the thing about it is,
they're all white.
It's 97%
Scandinavian. Yeah.
And like, of the 3% that aren't, they're like German immigrants into Scandinavian countries. And then you have this like 0.5% of other people. Now that is changing. You are seeing a lot more Muslim immigration into these countries because they're trying to escape a hellscape.
Yeah.
And that is changing. And that is changing. That's bringing up crazy radicalism in France. It's bringing it up in Germany. It's bringing it up in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they have a lot more homogenous culture. There's a reason why China has for 5,000 years been China.
Yeah. It's true. And when we think about that, I mean, it's, you're right. I think this is another one of those nuanced conversations that we can't ignore. Like, there's a reason that it's harder here, because we are one of the biggest melting pots in the entire world. And we just have to be that much more hopeful, and that much, and we have to work that much harder to overcome these issues and figure out how to have a heterogeneous society that is a society of options.
Right.
And that is a society where, again, I say it every fucking week, we are only as strong as the weakest among us.
Yeah.
And we've got to do our part to make sure that if we elevate
everyone,
if we elevate those people who are the poorest, if we elevate those people who have the least amount of privilege, we're only all going to do better for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we also have a strange view, a strange bastardization of economic theory in this country that somehow Reaganomics has, trickle down theory has persisted in popular culture, even though like every legitimate economist is like, what the fuck, who fucking made this shit up?
Right, right. Like, yeah, absolutely.
Why would you think that would work? Anyway, we're running low on time. I have to say, first of all, before we do my last little thing that we always do, I'm going to thank you now, but I'm going to thank you again in a minute because you came here on Valentine's Day, which is just the sweetest thing to do. And hopefully you and your man will be able to have a great time maybe hanging out in Hollywood.
Thanks. I think that's what I think we're going to go see Hollyhock House, which has been reopened for the first time in 3 years, the Frank Lloyd Wright House.
Cool. Yeah. Oh, I'm kind of jealous. That sounds like a good thing to do. Well, I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do for Valentine's Day. But anyway, it's like already 12:45. I'm like, what am I going to do? But before I let you go, I first want to close with the last two questions that I ask every guest on my podcast. The first being, when you look to the future, what is the thing that you're most concerned about or the thing that keeps you up most at night? But then on the flip side of that, the second question would be, what is the thing that excites you the most or makes you the most hopeful?
Mm.
Yeah. I like putting people on the spot.
I know, it's good. And I've heard people answer this on the show. It's and like, still I like still I'm on did the spot. Not. Yeah. I think in both senses, it's technology because there's so much momentum and things are progressing so quickly that there could be amazing changes within my lifetime. And at the same time, I'm also aware that your Samsung TV that you speak to could also be stealing your conversations and then selling your data. So I am very...
And by could, you mean is
currently
most
doing
likely.
It.
Yeah.
So I think in this continued exploration of the progress towards singularity of man and machine, that's all very wonderful and exciting and all slightly terrifying. And I do lay awake at night about it. I think one of the hardest things in having this wonderful conversation with you, and I cannot believe we haven't hung out more after all
I
this.
Know. Now we're going to have to.
Totally.
Yep.
But that it's hard to stay hopeful. It's hard to stay positive and optimistic. It's hard not to become a total cynic and depressed about the state of our current state and the future that may not be any better, maybe significantly bleaker than what we're dealing with at the moment. But I am continually inspired by the people in the Nerd Brigade and the people that I work with, the four women in Sirens, the three of us, three of them plus me. I see such hope and dedication to changing this future world that we live in. And I'm hoping that my generation, our generation, gets a chance to do what people in the 60s got to do and to pass civil rights and to pass Medicare and Medicaid and to pass these kind of big civic pieces of legislation that will change how we function. And that I believe firmly that technology will be a huge part of that, big component. And I hope that our better selves will keep financial interests at bay as much as possible. I guess, you know, enough to incentivize it, but not enough to completely taint it. As much as I hate being American, sometimes when I lived overseas, I was like, oh, wait, no, there are good things about this country.
Yeah.
It's good. I've never been fully groped in this country when walking in a giant urban area, but that's not true in Southern Europe.
So true.
You know, there's a lot of problems, but I'm so encouraged by these smart, young, ambitious people that I'm surrounded by, and I'm so grateful to have come to LA and to have met a group of like-minded people who celebrate this existence in this form.
And, you know, stepping back, there's a lot of problems, but that's also because there's so much progress.
Sure.
And I think sometimes we're really good about getting down on ourselves, but stopping and remembering these problems often come with this kind of progress.
Right.
The reason that we have issues with racism in this country is because we have different races in this country. You know what I mean? Like that's a good thing.
Right.
It's a bad thing that that there's still a lot of hatred and that there's still, we've come so far and we still have a lot more to go. But the fact that we can look out the window, we can walk down the street and see people that don't look anything like us and people that came from totally different cultures, that's a good thing. So sometimes we have to stop and remember that too and kind of see the forest for the trees. So, okay, first, before you go, I want you to let everybody know, A, how they can see Einstein's Girl, and if for whatever reason they live in a place where they're not able to see Einstein's Girl, how they can hear Einstein's Girl.
Yes. Well, easy enough. You can go to www.einsteinsgirl.com. I have three shows coming up in March on the East Coast, so if you're anywhere near there, you go ahead and pop on over to the site, and there's ticketing links and whatnot. I will probably be doing it again in Los Angeles later in the year. It's a big year because this is the 100th anniversary of general relativity. So there's a lot of Einstein celebrations going on. So
you can kind of be able to combine with those things.
Yeah. I'm hoping to, you know, attach my coattails to whatever soaring star is nearby celebrating. My guy. And you can also, there's lots of video clips on there, and I should be putting some more up soon. Things have been, it's weird. I have these like phases where Einstein's Girl is this huge prominent part of my life, and then sometimes she's a little dormant, but she'll probably come back in some other form, even if I'm not doing this necessarily this live show. I've got a couple of sitcom ideas that are in the can that are people are percolating with. So,
and you've also got a CD now linked to it, right?
Oh yes, there's an album, Einstein's Girl the album, and that's available on einsteinsgirl.com as well. So cool. It's $10. You can buy it on Bandcamp, and
it's awesome. You can support this amazing artist, hear her beautiful voice, and learn something along the way, which
absolutely.
Is very cool. And also, we didn't talk much about it, but I do want to make sure that you can give a shout out to the Sirens. You guys know now 50% of the Sirens because this is Gia and Christina Ochoa was on the podcast. So what about the other 50%, and how can they reach out to you guys and see what you guys are up to?
Absolutely. Please do reach out to us. So we're at Sirens, S-C-I-R-E-N-S on Twitter, and we're pretty active on there, but you can also go to the website, which is Sirens, S-C-I-R-E-N-S.com. Sign up for our mailing list, which is, there's nothing to be mailed at the moment, but things are happening there. We are talking big development stuff with both nonfiction and fiction television pieces, and we occasionally host live events, and we share science news, and we are specifically concerned with scientific literacy in the general populace and using entertainment as a way to communicate science to people who may otherwise not really have access to it or understand it or have an interest in it at all.
I absolutely love it. Just much like how the Nerd Brigade is a group of kind of scientists and scientifically educated people who do science communication who want to improve literacy, Sirens specifically, what's so cool about them is it's this group of like amazing actresses who are really interested in improving science literacy, which to a lot of people seems like
Exactly.
But that's what's so great about it. It's these four brilliant, beautiful women who are really doing their part. And in some ways, I think have the potential to do even more because they have access to nonfiction programming, or I'm sorry, to fiction programming, not just nonfiction programming like what I do on television. They are playing characters on television, and they are, like you said, developing sitcoms and doing things like that. And so they can think about the way that science can actually be represented in the type of media that I think in many ways shapes our perceptions.
Absolutely. I have a friend who's a TV writer named Roger Wolfson, who was the youngest speechwriter ever on John Kerry's in his campaign. And he has passed billions of dollars of legislation. Mm-hmm. He was a big-time politico and has since left and become a TV writer because he outright believes that he can do more good socially writing for television than he can in writing legislation.
Yeah, he likely can. Yeah. And that's something that, again, I've talked about this movie on the podcast. Sorry, I've been traveling a lot. My voice is weird. Is that better? Yeah. I've been talking about this movie a lot on the podcast, but if you haven't seen the documentary Misrepresentation by Jennifer Siebel Newsom, I definitely recommend you see it because that's exactly what she talks about. She talks about both in political arenas, in nonfiction programming, like in news, and current events, but also in fiction programming, television and film, how are women represented? What kinds of positions of power do they have? How are they represented in the sciences, in political arenas? And I think that it's important to see what kind of social change we can affect just by making decisions at those levels about the characters that that we're showing.
The Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media has done significant studies on this as well. It's pretty incredible if you go to their website, which is cjane.org. And you can read all those stats from worldwide looking at how women are portrayed in film and television, in fiction programming. And
yeah, I think that they actually do a lot of work together. I first met Jennifer Siepel Newsom because they came to HuffPost back when I was working there. And I think Gina Davis came too. And they did a whole really cool presentation about it for all of the female reporters there and the female editors so that we could learn a little bit more about the steps that we could take.
So great.
Yeah, it was really cool. So, and then separate from all of that, let everybody know how they can, you know, reach out to you, Twitter, Facebook, all that good stuff.
Yes. So I'm on Facebook, either Gia Mora, you can friend me. It will be so intimate and
nice.
Cozy. Yeah. But I also have a fan page that you can like, so you could, you know, give me a thumbs up there. And that is also Gia Mora. So you can search under both of those. And then on Twitter, I am Ms.MIZ_Mora.
Love
it. You can find me there. Yeah.
So everybody, say hi to Gia. Thank her for being on the show. It was so much fun, Gia.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm so glad we did this. And everybody out there, I'm looking forward to the next time we get together to talk nerdy.